standing in the middle of a street in a small rural town. I'm getting emotional again. In the middle of Conservative Ireland and asking people to vote yes to allow abortion is really not an easy thing at all, to say the least. Yet people are willing to do it, knowing that you may be ostracised from your community or lose friendships or respect from neighbours. So that was really, really hard. And yet people did it.
Welcome back to How the Yes Was Won, a podcast about the Eighth Amendment. May 25th, 2018, the day GDPR became law. No, JK, it was the day Ireland voted to repeal the Eighth. Together for Yes had been running their campaign for 2 months, as had the No side. For many of us, we'd been leafleting every morning and canvassing every night for so long that we'd forgotten what free time was. Now the day to actually vote had arrived. Under Irish law, it is illegal to campaign on the day of an election. So what could we do? Well, first of all, we had to vote and make sure everybody else voted too. Here's Linda Kavanagh from ARC.
The day of the vote, yeah, so I got up a little bit later than usual, went to vote, got dressed up, nice makeup, because it was important, you know. And then it was weird because I went to vote and I was on my own. And that was probably the first thing I'd done on my own in this whole campaign. It was so weird. It just didn't feel real. Like everything I've done in this has been a collective of women mostly working together towards a goal. And this was the first solo kind of thing that I'd done. It was really, really odd. It felt really surreal. And then I went into, so while there's a moratorium for traditional media, there's not for social media. So we had to still work. So we were in there, but it was really weird because it was kind of not obvious, but it was like, it was a strong opening day, you know, like we knew a lot of people had got out and it was, the visibility was there. And we knew we had our jobs. We were like dogs at the polling booth. That's a big social media moment. You do that. There was also really, really lovely stories. Sarah Reardon, who postponed her breast cancer surgery so she could vote. People who were like, I'm going to leg it from my daughter's wedding to go and vote and then head back up. Those kind of stories, and people who'd just given birth actually was one. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So all of these things were coming in and, you know, we're monitoring them and sharing them. And then people were coming in and out. So we were in our war room, as we called it, on the first floor of the headquarters, and people were coming in and out. They were canvassing and stuff. And I was like, you know, get down, because it was a gorgeous day and everyone in Dublin leaves Dublin when it's a really nice day. So I was like, get down the canal if there's anyone drinking. And it was empty, apparently. That was the thing. Like, you should have known then. That was another indicator.
Many of you listening may have been on the Together for Yes mailing list, and maybe you received alarming emails on the evening of May 25th saying turnout was low and for people to do more to get out the vote. Linda told us more about that.
Yeah, this is bad form and I would apologise, but I'm actually not sorry at all. So the plan always is to say turnout is low, but we couldn't say that because turnout was record high, like, and we knew it. So we kind of were like, oh, okay, what are we going to do? So then we were like, we had gotten some stuff in, like, this was not made up. We had gotten some stuff in that it had been strong in the morning and then it wasn't strong in the afternoon in certain areas. So we decided to do the orange warning and the flashing red GIF. And maybe we should have told our supporters that this was a tactic, but we didn't. And we then, I will just say that we bought our own bullshit and then we were panicking. But the panic that we had created, we were panicking. So literally, Sarah Clarkin was lying on the ground, having a panic attack with coats over her head. I was like bent over, clutching my stomach, going, oh my God, the anxiety. So Emma, who also worked with us, she had to go for a couple of hours and she came back. And when she left, we were fine. And when she came back 6 hours later, we were dying. We were absolutely in bits. And she was like, cop on. We were like, no, we bought our own bullshit. Like, we knew we had done this, but we still bought it. So, yeah, it was absolutely demented.
See, you're the person responsible for my mental breakdown at 5 p.m. on Friday afternoon. While I got those emails, I was like, turn it low. And I was like, oh, my God.
Listen, lads, it worked, okay? I know some, like, I've been told, like, I know there was people crying. No, it's bad, but also, though, I know some people lost their dang minds and they were like going into pubs and like, you know, shoving people out the door. And then, but then I know somebody who was like, their dad kind of saw it and was like, he decided to go down at like 9:30. So like, we'll just say.
Yeah.
Polling stations were open from 7 a.m. until 10 p.m. on the 25th. We knew there would be two exit polls, one from the Irish Times at 10 p.m. and then one from RTE at about 11 on the Late Late Show. Campaigners were preparing themselves to get the first indication of if we'd done enough. Remember, this was a campaign that broke Irish political fundraising records. It was a campaign that baffled regular media and political outlets. You couldn't walk down any street in Ireland without half the people you saw wearing repeal jumpers. But still, in our little repealy bubbles, we didn't know if the yes would win.
Coming into this, we were on the back of, you know, Trump winning and Brexit happening. So polls being not trusted. We knew that that poll was coming in at 10 o'clock and we were dreading it because I'll just say now, I kind of think it's horseshit when people say that they knew it was won, but maybe they did. But I thought maybe we had won by 51%, 50.5%, 52%. I thought it was going to be a scrappy down to the wire. We'd go to the count the next day and it'd be like, yes, one county, no one county. And it was going to be all down to the wire. I was dreading that poll because I was like, it's going to come in at 52 and you've got your margin of error is 3%. We don't know. And we'll just spend the whole night being anxious and be absolutely wrecked. It'll be awful. And so around 9 o'clock, Deirdre Duffy came up to us and she was like, look, come on downstairs. Like, you know, you've done, because we were sitting there waiting for the poll. And so we, it was really nice. So people were there with beers and pizzas and there was a couple of speeches. Like I remember at Grainne, Griffin kind of stood up and said, look, no matter what happens now, we've changed the conversation. We've changed the country. Thank you so much. Everyone gave everything that they could. And I remember it was Nikki Gallagher's voice was the one going, it's a landslide. Her screeching. And then Sarah Clark was like, for which way? And like her now husband was like, for you. And yeah, so we partied. So basically that came in at 69% and we took a lot of photographs with 69%. There was crying. So the first poll came in and some people were like, oh, no, this is just the first poll. It's just a poll, guys. Just a poll, chill out. But no, it was gone at that stage. And then the second poll came in and we were like, okay, you can't get it 18 points wrong. Like if you're polling and you get it 18 points wrong, should be fired. It's polling. So yeah, so we partied and it was funny because we went out onto a lot of abortion rights campaign. People went out onto the steps and we recorded a message just to kind of for people who were in other parts of the country. And so like, so I know Cuiva was in Cork and she, you know, the first they went to the poll, but they were all kind of tense and silent. And then that poll came in and they were still like, no, I don't believe it. And we sent Cuiva that message. And like, we were drinking it, you know, delighted with life at that stage. And she was like, well, they're celebrating up in Dublin, so I think we might be okay.
All over the country, people were coming together in front of TVs in homes and pubs waiting for the polls to come in. We asked Emily Wozak from Merge where she was the evening of the vote.
I had met someone after work for some pints and then all the Merge people were meeting up at one of our members' house for a pasta party. And then I don't think any of us could vote, actually. Maybe one or two of us had voted. And then we were meeting a bunch of comrades over at the Hop House in town. And so it was like a 5-minute walk from the Gaff and we were a little bit drunk and we were walking down the street. So we just decided, like, let's take the street. So we took the street, like we marched, like, you know, 15 of us at most marching through the street, down Dominic Street, like down Parnell Street to get to the Hop House. We passed a church and they were all very like cross with us. They were all wearing their no, you know, save the eighth kind of things, and we were just like chanting and singing. Yeah, singing Bella Ciao. Like, oh God, it was the best. We were just, because we were just so, there needed to be some catharsis for us as well, because we couldn't vote. I think that was for a lot of people, like ticking that box was just like, oh, this kind of like relief. Okay. And then a little bit of anxiety, whereas we didn't really have that necessarily. So we needed something. So yeah, we marched, we chanted, we chanted all the way into the bar. And then I remember the smoking area, we were marching out to the smoking area, and I just heard, because they could hear us, and I heard someone, like one of our pals, be like, oh shit, Merge is in the house. Because they, you know, you could hear us from anywhere and know that it's us, which was really like exciting. And like, it felt like this really great kind of like camaraderie, and also this acknowledgement of our role in the referendum that had not existed.
After the Irish Times poll came in, there was a slight disbelief that we'd be ahead by so much. So, for the first time in many of our lives, young people all over Ireland tuned in to watch The Late Late Show to have the results confirmed by the RTE poll. Here's Cathy Shields.
The exit polls, I was saying, I went into, there's this wee pub in my hometown called Farns that I've started drinking in, and it's just this very small country pub, but the family who owned it are very nice. And I went in and was like, Charlie, would you put on The Late Late for me? And he's like, no bother. So I was there with like me and my mum, and I was just like watching like with disbelief. I really didn't expect them to be that high. Like, up until the day before, I wasn't even sure that we were going to win. Do you know what I mean? There's just this mad fear that's just based on being a woman in Ireland all my life. Like, no, they'll never ever let us do anything that's good for us, so don't get your hopes up. And then I drank far more pints than I should have, because I was like, they like us, they really like us, Mom, isn't this great?
As you've heard, it was an incredible relief to hear the two exit polls, to think that yes, we had done enough. For us, it had been about 6 years of campaigning, but for a small few, this fight had been going on for over 35 years. Here's Mary Gordon, who you'll remember from episode one.
My experience on the day of the result. I was with the Women's Information Network. We had a reunion the night of the vote and the poll.
This time around?
Yeah, in 2018.
The exit poll.
And we were sitting having dinner, feeling very nervous when the exit poll results came out. And Janie, I've never enjoyed myself as much as in that company that night. It was just magnificent. So in a way, over my lifetime, or a lot of my lifetime, to have seen the day when Irish people, as a population, are now so liberal compared to the Ireland I grew up in, is still feels like a great thing, I have to say.
By May 26th, we knew we had won, but we still had to count the votes. Conference centres and sports halls all over the country became count centres, where the votes for each constituency were counted up and reported to the main count centre at Dublin Castle. Together for Yes had booked a function room in the hotel opposite the RDS, which was the central count centre for Dublin. Here's Linda again.
I didn't go to the count. Because I thought it was going to be that scrappy down to the wire thing, I just couldn't face anti-choice people. I just was absolutely like, I'm not going to be able to do this. Now, other people love the count. So like, literally there was fights over, you know, and all kinds of politics, Games of Thrones stuff happening over who got to go to the count. I had no interest. So I was happy to go. We had the Intercontinental, big ballroom in the Intercontinental. And there was a little room that was a little media room at the side, because we had a plan for social media if it went no. And we had a plan for if it went scrappy down to the wire. And we had absolutely no plan for a landslide. So we didn't know what to do. But it was just mad. So there was a couple of people looking at the counts and kind of tallying up all that kind of stuff digitally. And then we were looking at the different counties, because the idea was that if a county came in for no, we would post photos of them and we would say thanks to the campaigners there. You got 70,000 yes votes. Unbelievable achievement. But it was all bloody yeses. So bar the one, which was the last one, you know.
In the morning of the count, I was very hungover getting to, like, because the count centre was like an hour and 10 minutes away from where I'm from, to, you know, Donegal's big like that. The late late poll the night before, it was like 69% or something. I was like, Jesus, if it's 69%, maybe even Donegal voted yes. But up until that, I hadn't really thought that Donegal would vote yes. But I'd always hoped, you know, like, but it was still like, and I suppose from being on canvassing and stuff, it was just, it was really disappointing. And as soon as Inishon came back, no, because Inishon had come back quite strongly in support of marriage equality. And as soon as I came back, no, I was like, fuck, well, that's that then. And we sat around all day knowing that it was a no, but waiting because I think like basically HQ didn't want any no's coming out until later in the evening, do you know? It was like, and then because Tim Jackson and I had been interviewed beside each other so many times over, you know, the year previously.
Tim Jackson is an anti-choice politician from Donegal who went on fake hunger strike to stop repeal.
Whenever it was over, I was like, well, Tim, sure, you must be pleased with how that went in Donegal. And he was like, I'm just sad about all the babies that are going to die. And I can't tell if that was a line or if he meant it. I really can't. So yeah, I still have loads of mixed feelings about the day of the count because I was mostly just dejected, even though like we'd won and this was like, you know, the fruits of like 6 years of like constant volunteering. And I just, I don't know, I just didn't really sink in, or like, well, that's not really the way to describe it because it did sink in. I knew that we'd won, but it was just, walking around like not happy. There was a few comments made in the days afterwards, but there was a couple of really strong rebuttals. There was like a young doctor, Noel Sharkey, who was involved with the marriage equality campaign and who also spoke, you know, as, you know, a doctor for choice in Donegal. And he just wrote like a thread on Twitter that was like, you know, before you get smart, you know, and he just broke down all of the different reasons, you know, why it was such a difficult campaign in Donegal compared to other parts of the country, which isn't to say that it wasn't difficult elsewhere, but there was just a lot of challenges in Donegal, and I think we did really well, to be honest. Like, it was so close, it wasn't like it was a, you know, a really big discrepancy between the yeses and the noes. And women in Donegal now have abortion whether they voted for it or not, so you're welcome. Yeah, do you know, I hope that you never need to access one, but if you do, you'll be able to.
Thanks to the incredible work of volunteers like Kathy, it was a landslide. Ireland voted to repeal the eighth by 66.4%. 1,429,981 people voted yes, and the turnout was 64%. The official result will be announced from Dublin Castle later in the afternoon. Just like with marriage equality, people descended on the castle courtyard to be there to hear the official results being read out and celebrate together. The eyes of the world were on Ireland. There was a big presence from international media outlets in the run-up to the vote, all covering so-called Catholic Ireland voting for abortion access, missing the nuances and the journey the country had been on. Politicians and campaigners stood on a temporary dais in Dublin Castle courtyard and smiled, waved and applauded to the crowd. The then Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, addressed the media that afternoon. He described the campaign as a quiet revolution. We put that claim to every single person we interviewed, and here are some of our favourite responses.
And I always think of it, actually, when, you know, after the vote, Varadkar had this whole thing about a quiet revolution. Like, I was like, I just felt there was this, like, cacophony of noise. Like, there was so much going on, like, and he's like, a quiet revolution? I was like, you just weren't listening, like, there was loads of us.
He obviously has been listening to women for the previous 35 years. And it's not surprising he ignored the years of work done by grassroots groups who were all shouting very loudly about this.
I like to swear. It was outrageous. I actually like to think that one irritating sod of a man could take the good out of the moment like that. I was shocked to my core. I was like, oh my God, you even ruined this. Like, I cannot believe that this has just happened. Like, on national television, this is, oh, you fucking bollocks. Raging, absolutely raging. There was nothing quiet about it. He just wasn't listening. None of them were listening until they were made listen. And they were made listen by loud, shrill, angry feminists shouting over and over and over again until it was suddenly on their agenda and became something they wanted to be part of. So, yeah, you can shove it up your hole.
Oh, God. Leo Varadkar is especially infuriating for me. I'm mixed race. I'm the same age as him. I'm the daughter of a migrant as well. But it's absolutely outrageous for him to say this, because he was the one who was silencing us for so long. He has a long track record of flip-flopping anyway. But yeah, it's absolutely fucking patronizing. And it was always going to happen that way. But at the same time, we kind of let that happen when we sort of gave over the reins, when we were like taking pictures with politicians and like asking Fine Gael to like join us in strategy and whatever. So like, it's his prerogative to say it, man. Like, we kind of gave him the keys to the castle in a way, but still, fuck him. Like, it wasn't a quiet revolution. It was really loud. It was quiet-ish for a long time. I think there was a lot of self-censorship that happened because of like deep, dark histories of oppression. But like, I think his idea of quiet is different to mine.
It's just a history of activism.
Yeah.
And when they said, you were the ones who brought it up, quiet revolution, it was no more a quiet revolution. We've been screeching and roaring and shouting and placarding and, you know, being arrested and being, you know, the kind of thing. So it was no way quiet. It just happened to be not on their agenda.
And we agree. And after 9 episodes, we hope you do too.
The really good, amazing thing about this campaign is that it was owned by so many people. Like, it's not, like, I have ownership of it, being in headquarters, but it also is that mom in Mayo who took her buggy and a handful of leaflets and canvassed her street in her own because she knew it wasn't going to happen otherwise. She owns the campaign as much as I do. And I hope people know that. Like, they're not written out of it. Like,
the campaign to repeal the 8th was owned by everyone involved. And everyone has their own story to tell about how they repealed the 8th. This podcast is just one story of repeal. It doesn't cover everything, and it's not the only story. We've already heard lots of other stories in films, podcasts, blog posts, and books, and we look forward to hearing even more. So, what's next? Well, Ireland's not fixed. The 8th Amendment was repealed, and there is legislation for abortion access now, but it's not good enough. The people who were most affected by the 8th Amendment are still the same people who struggle to access care today. We have a 12-week gestational limit, which needs to be increased. We also have a completely clinically unnecessary 3-day waiting period between requesting and receiving an abortion, which means that people need to travel to their GP twice and limits access to the service, especially in rural areas.
It's fine to be free, safe, legal if you're somewhere that you can access it. But there's no point in us having free, safe, legal if it's a case that you can't access it locally. And we still have that problem in Tipperary. We still don't have enough access. We don't have enough GPs that are offering the services. We just don't have the access for it. You still have situations where we'll take, for example, a woman that's in an abusive relationship that lives in a small village outside a town and might only go to that main town once a week for her to do her weekly shopping. How does she explain to her partner, well, instead of doing my usual Thursday or Friday trip for to go to the local Tesco or Aldi, I'm going on a Monday or a Tuesday. And then having to repeat that again because you have to go back after a couple of days because you need 2 visits to a GP. So that negatively impacts more in rural Ireland than it would do in urban areas.
The legislation also doesn't cover any exclusion zones outside of clinics or protection for doctors, which means protesters can and do ring GPs who they suspect of providing abortions to pressure them to stop. Together for Safety is a new national campaign that is calling for the implementation of safe access zones around family planning centres, maternity hospitals and healthcare facilities.
Yeah, it was good. But of course, like, I mean, to be honest, like, we were celebrating, but in the back of our heads the whole time was like, there's still a lot to go. Like, we still have a lot of work to do because we knew conscientious objection was there. We knew people were trusting doctors. We knew that doctors were not our friends because they had come out in support of conscientious objection. We knew that that was going to be the, like, pretty much the biggest barrier. That and term limits were going to be kind of the biggest barriers for us. And of course, like, our work doesn't end. Like, we still have problems in maternity services. We still have housing crisis. We still have racism and the rise of the far right. So, yes. So it's kind of like a whoop up, like, yeah, oh, but okay, now we know how much work we're going to have to do.
Maternity care in Ireland is not fixed. In Her Shoes was an online phenomenon that told the stories of people affected by the Eighth Amendment. There's now a new online account, In Her Shoes COVID Pregnancy, which aims to raise awareness of the strict regulations that have been in place since March 2020, which force people to use Irish maternity services alone, separated from partners during appointments, inductions, full labour and inpatient stays. Pubs, shops and restaurants are reopening, but there's no movement on allowing the partners of pregnant people into hospitals, regardless of vaccine or test status. Once again, we're hearing about the poor and sometimes traumatising treatment of pregnant people in Irish hospitals. We're also facing the very real threat that the new National Maternity Hospital will be owned by the Sisters of Charity. I don't think we need to go into too much more detail on why the church needs to be kept as far away from people who can get pregnant bodies as possible. There's a growing movement to oppose this, and we encourage you to get involved however you can. Dunleary Together for Yes have rebranded as Dunleary Together for Choice and Equality and can be found on Instagram and Twitter campaigning to keep the state-funded hospital in state hands. There is also Northern Ireland. In Dublin Castle on the day of the count, people were already holding signs saying the North is next and now for NI, reflecting the long-standing solidarity between pro-choice and feminist groups on the whole island of Ireland. In May 2018, Northern Ireland still only permitted abortion if a pregnant person's life was at risk or if there was a risk of permanent and serious damage to their mental or physical health. Abortion was decriminalised in Northern Ireland in October 2019. However, the Minister for Health, Robin Swan, and the Department of Health have failed to commission services now required by law. This has resulted in women and pregnant people continuing to travel to seek abortion care that is technically legal there during a pandemic. Reproductive freedom will always be used as a political tool. And speaking of body autonomy, trans healthcare in Ireland is abysmal. Trans people were a key part of the campaign to repeal the Eighth. What about them? Trans people in Ireland today are still travelling for healthcare. There is a 3-year waiting list for initial referrals to the National Gender Service. Trans people cannot wait this long. There's no specific trans healthcare service for youth or adolescents. The system we have uses psychiatric evaluations, which is an outdated model of care and not best practice. Trans activists want this to be replaced with the informed consent model. Trans people now are travelling abroad for medical procedures and then not receiving aftercare support when they get back. They just want to be treated at home, to receive healthcare at home. Does this sound familiar? So what about lessons learned for next time?
There's nothing like kind of those two mornings, one in 2015 and one in 2018, and I don't want to go through it again. I kind of said when we kind of a couple of weeks later when we'd kind of gotten out of referendum mode slightly, but I still wanted to fight for something, because I think one of the easiest ways for us to actually see change in Ireland is now through referendum, and I guess we need to probably look at putting things in. Because I think we've managed to mobilise people twice now, and we need to look at how we keep mobilising and keep mobilising for human rights. And I think we probably need to look at putting things into the constitution, not taking them out. So putting in the right to housing, putting in like human rights, actually embedding human rights into the constitution, looking at how we can include people.
We have to have a lot more national conversations. What about the right for all children born in Ireland to automatically be Irish citizens? In 2004, we voted against that in a referendum. The Constitution states that we can legislate for this, so thankfully we shouldn't have to drag ourselves all over the country to beg for human rights again. But we do need to put pressure on the government to change this law. Already we've seen multiple cases of children facing deportation to countries they've never lived in. It's horrendous. It's racist, and we need to fix it. We've had 21 years of direct provision, essentially internment for asylum seekers. That needs to end. We haven't even begun to acknowledge the harm done to women in Magdalen laundries and mother and baby institutions. We've just had the final report of the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes earlier this year, and it has been met with widespread derision by survivors, many of whom statements were misrepresented or lost. They were promised so much and given so little. Together for Yes followed the handbook of Yes Equality. Both were huge campaigns which captured the hearts of young people all over the country. But both also excluded people as part of their strategy. Young people in Ireland now are used to winning. But we need to try winning together. Many thanks to Anne Connolly, Alison Spillane, Anita Byrne, Cathy Shields, Eddie Conlon, Emily Wozak, Ivana Bacek, Linda Kavanagh, Mary Gordon, Mary McAuliffe, Mary McDermott, Mary Ryder, Maeve Taylor, Niall Behan, Sam Blankensee, Sarah Monaghan, Sean O'Brien and Ursula Barry for speaking to us for this series, Icons Only. We're so grateful to everyone who spoke to us for this project. We couldn't get over people's willingness to meet with us and share their stories and experiences with us. Many thanks to them all. This podcast was made on less than a shoestring and was only possible with people's generosity and support. Absolute thanks to Noreen and Noel Kelly, who let us use their dining room as a podcast studio so often. We truly couldn't have made this without you. Also thanks to Clodagh Leonard for being so quiet while I record this. Thanks to Finn Dwyer for the loan of his podcast mic. You can have it back now, Finn. Many thanks to our family and friends who have listened to us talk about making a podcast for the last 3 years. It's finally here and we hope you love it as much as we do. Next week, we're going to share some of our favourite stories that didn't make the cut and we hope you like them. How the Yes Was Won was researched, produced and edited by Deirdre Kelly, Aisling Dolan, that's me, Emma Callahan, Davy Quinlivan and Tara Loney. Additional recording support from Finn Dwyer. Thanks for listening.